This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
David Elliott joins us on the line from Washington, D.C. to talk about GLBT issues from the national perspective. Then we have News Wrap for news coverage of GLBT issues from around the world by the crew of This Way Out. It was GLBT Lobby Day at the Texas Legislature in Austin this past week, and our own Jennifer Renee Poole was there. Tonight she'll be telling us about that experience. And then in the second hour, the Gay Men's Chorus of Houston offers up the best of the New York theater scene, along with the Bayou City Chorale's second stand-alone performance. This event features guest artists, and we'll be talking with a couple of the folks from those organizations about that upcoming event. The 2001 CD Slow Burn Avenue and the 2005 release titled Cardboard Logic are the work of Andy Northrup. Both those discs have been well received, and Andy will be interviewed this evening. By the way, he was honored by the Stonewall Society for their Musical Artist of the Year Award in 2005. Also, the Houston Pride Band Winter Concert event called The Best of All Possible Worlds. It's at the Resurrection Metropolitan Community Church, and we'll find out more about that in the second hour. And also This Way Out's feature segment on Sean Penn, winning the Oscar for Best Actor for his portrayal of San Francisco supervisor Harvey Milk.
Great. And shortly, David Elliott will be calling us in. As you said, Jennifer just came back from Austin.
Yeah, just drove in. Got back about an hour and a half ago, something like that. Enough time. I did a few interviews. Didn't have much of a chance to do any editing, but I did bring two of the interviews with us that I'll interlace with the interview we're going to do in the second segment.
Great. And David Elliott is on with us on the line. And I want to say two things before you get started. One is Happy Texas Independence Day. And number two, are you out there shoveling snow?
Well, Jack, first of all, Happy Texas Independence Day to you, too. I miss all of you folks down there. Of course, I grew up in Austin, Texas, and went to the University of Texas. And I miss it a lot, especially because tonight we are going to have the coldest day in history in Washington, D.C. on March 2nd.
Really?
It's going to get down to 10 degrees or below. Our previous low was 11 degrees. And, you know, I live in an apartment, so I don't have to shovel snow myself. But I have to tell you, it was a bit of a trouble getting to work today.
I guess this is all because of the CPAC convention.
Well, yeah, we're blaming it on them. You know, we're not blaming it on the thousands and thousands of young activists who came to D.C. Over the weekend and planned to protest in front of Congress today to talk about global warming. that was a bit of a, you know, mistimed event, perhaps.
So how much snow did you get?
Well, here in the district, we got about 6 or 7 inches. It feels like a lot more because it's hard for us to handle it here.
Right.
You know, imagine Houston getting 2 or 3 inches of snow. And, you know, that's what it's like for us to get 7 inches. And most of it all came at once between about 6 a.m. and 8 a.m. this morning, which caused havoc on rush hour. And in fact, the federal government today, with its hundreds and hundreds of thousands of employees, did not even open until 11 a.m.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, what do you got for us today?
Well, you know, first of all, good evening to you, and hello everybody out there listening to Queer Voices. You know, thank the Lord that you all exist and that people have this resource. Tonight is the 41st night of the administration of President Barack Obama. And can we just stop and remark about that? What it means to say the Obama administration?
Yes, isn't that incredible?
I mean, how wonderful that is. And Jack, I have to ask you, who do you have in studio with you tonight?
Jennifer's with us.
I'm here.
Hi, Jennifer. How are you?
Jennifer just got back from Austin for Lobby Day.
Yay!
And we'll be talking about that in the next segment.
Great. Well, listen, tonight I want to talk to you about two historic and transformative pieces of legislation. One has passed Congress. The other is pending. Let's start off by talking about what's passed Congress. I'm talking about the Jobs and Economic Recovery Package. Many people know this by the name of the stimulus package. We don't like to use that phrase because when we did polling and focus groups and stuff like that, Americans heard the phrase stimulus package and they were like, what's that? Is that about Viagra? Is that some European thing? They just didn't really get it. So we called it the Jobs and Economic Recovery Package. And this was an important piece of legislation. It was the introduction to a new chapter in American history. It wasn't that first chapter. It was simply the introduction. What we realized in working so hard to pass this thing, you know, my organization, U.S. Action, led a coalition of 60 other nonprofits in rallying grassroots support to pass it. What we realized is that an economic crisis that is deep and seemingly endless requires an historic response. And this bill was the beginning of that response. And it was the beginning in four areas, my friends. Those four areas are in healthcare, in education, in environment and energy efficiency, and in infrastructure. And I'm going to go through those really, really briefly. In healthcare, the bill provides hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars so that states can continue Medicaid programs so that people in Texas and in other states aren't cut off, if they're at the poverty level, from receiving really needed, crucial health care. It also does another historic thing, which sounds incredibly dull, but it's also incredibly important. It provides a couple of $1 billion to pay for putting our medical records online so that if you go from one doctor to another doctor, they don't have to do your whole medical history all over again. They don't have to do the tests all over again. They don't have to interview you and ask you those invasive questions all over again.
You know, David, I don't understand why this isn't already done by the industry.
Well, exactly, Jack. That's a big duh. Nobody understands. I mean, it's simple. If you were a car manufacturer, and I was actually interviewing the owner of a car repair shop today, and he was telling me that he's been online with his customers and their needed car repairs for 10 years now. And he was like, we do this with cars and repairs. Why in the world haven't we done it with healthcare?
Exactly.
It's mind-boggling. So, you know, the healthcare component of this was really historic. But then let's talk about education. In one fell swoop, with a stroke of his pen, President Obama, for the next 2 years, basically doubled the federal government's commitment to education. Historically, recent years, the federal government has spent about 7%, has made up about 7% of a local school district's budget. Now, because of this Jobs and Economic Recovery Package, that's going to go up to 13%. Now, one reason why this is so important is it means that a lot of school district, a lot of teachers, a lot of school counselors, nutrition experts, other folks in HISD, Houston Independent School District, other places, aren't going to be laid off, who would have been laid off. It's also important because there's an interconnection, and you'll hear this a whole lot, between health care and education. Municipalities across the country, school districts across the country, are having to lay people off, not just because of the economic downturn, mind you, but because of the rising costs of health care. There's the health care makes up 1/6 of our economy, and its tentacles run through every single issue that we deal with, including LGBT rights, health care, including civil rights, including environment and energy issues. I mean, just including so much. Now, the third reason why this jobs and economic recovery package was so historic has to do with environmental issues, energy efficiency issues. Did you know, Jack, did you know, Jennifer, that this is the first energy bill, well, the first bill that contains a major energy component, to pass Congress that gave nothing away to the coal industry and gave nothing away to the nuclear power industry? It was a green bill.
What about the oil industry?
You know, I'm not so sure about that. I'll have to do my homework
and,
on
and
that.
And I, if they did, it certainly was less than what was given away in the last administration.
Well, and in fact, we can talk about that in the next bill that I'm going to talk about in a minute, which has to do with the 2010 budget proposal, which the oil industry is not happy about. But let me just close this section by talking about the fourth reason why the jobs and economic recovery package was so important, and that has to do with infrastructure. You know, a year and a half ago, we had a bridge collapse in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Lots of people were killed. Several years before that, we had the levees collapse, of course, famously, in New Orleans during Hurricane Katrina. We had, here in D.C., just 2 months ago, a giant sinkhole during rush hour out in Montgomery County, Maryland, Bethesda, Maryland, and people had to be rescued with boats and helicopters because, you know, 25-degree water was entering their cars and they were in danger of drowning because a water main broke, a 5.5-foot wide water main broke because it hadn't been serviced in 20 years. The fact is, back in the 1950s, our country built up all of this infrastructure, and we haven't maintained it. And that's part of keeping America strong and keeping America secure, is maintaining our infrastructure. So that's the last reason why the jobs and economic recovery package is important. I want to go on and talk about the second piece of legislation I mentioned, which is President Obama's proposed budget. Now, you know, Jack, Jennifer, I know that when I say proposed budget or budget debate pending in Congress, people's eyes glaze over. I know it sounds really, really dull, but this piece of legislation that's pending right now and will be decided between now and mid-April is the most transformative, is the most historic piece of legislation that we have dealt with in our lifetimes. You have to go all the way back, maybe you could make this argument, that LBJ's plan to extend and create a federal highway system in, you know, 1965 was this historic. But I don't even think it was. I actually think you have to go all the way back to the 1930s and talk about FDR's New Deal when you're looking at what this budget does. It's a large budget. It's $3.55 trillion. $1 trillion is a daunting figure. It's basically a 1 followed by 12 zeros. It's the sum of $1 million times $1 million. That's how you get to $1 trillion. That's a lot of money. But remember, Americans are spending a lot more than that every year on health care costs alone. If Americans could see what they were spending on health care the same way they see what they spend on the price of gasoline, you know, like you drive into work and you pass two or three different gas stations and you see the price of gas posted. Imagine if Americans could see the price of their health care posted. It would just
It would be staggering.
Yeah, right, it would blow everybody's mind.
Yeah, and we pay the most for it and get the least for it of any Western country.
But well, it's even worse than that. We rank 24th in the world in terms of the quality of health care we provide our citizens. And all 23 countries ahead of us provide health care to everybody, and they do it on average for half the cost. Now, I want to read you a quote. This quote comes from President Obama during the speech he gave to Congress 6 days ago, Tuesday night of last week. He said, "We must have quality, affordable health care for every American. Health care reform cannot wait, it must not wait, and it will not wait another year." And we really rejoiced when we heard that quote, you know, because we have been pushing for quality, affordable health care for all. That's our slogan, and that's our a statement of our principles, which Obama signed on to last summer as a candidate. And so it was just really, really exciting to hear that. Now, I want to go into a couple of details about President Obama's budget. And I'm trying to be mindful of the time here, so I'm going to try to go a little bit quickly. The overview is Obama basically is proposing a budget that asks our country to act boldly and wisely to make investments that are critical to our economic future. He's calling for ending our dependence on foreign oil. He's calling for creating millions of clean energy jobs. He's calling for bringing down the high cost of health care. He's calling for giving all of our kids access to a world-class education so that they can compete in the 21st century economy. If we do that, if we pass this budget proposal, we will lay the groundwork so that we can make our economy strong for years to come, in addition to getting us out of the mess we're in. Now, you know, in the interest of time, I'm not going to go through all of those items: health care, clean energy, education, and so on and so forth. But I do want to try to offer some context here. We've seen years and years. You can go back 8 years if you want to, or you can go back 28 years if you want to, all the way back to January, 1981, when Ronald Reagan was elected. We have seen 8 years or 28 years of failed policies, of upside-down economics, you know, transferring wealth in this country from the middle class to the upper class. And the budget that President Obama has proposed is a fundamental difference between those, you know, from those policies. We're talking about a president who inherited the nation's worst economic crisis in generations. We're talking about a president who inherited the largest deficit in history. And now we're talking about a budget that really fundamentally resets our country's priorities, our nation's priorities, our community's priorities in historic fashion so that we can rebuild, renew our country for the challenges that we face. You know, we're talking about returning fairness to our tax code.
Right.
You know, significant down payments on health care reform, an energy policy to reverse global climate change, investments in education, We are talking about a blueprint for transformational, there's that word again, change. And after all, this is what we voted for, well, most states, in November. And so now, what we have to be about is a massive grassroots campaign to pass this budget. And I want to close, and you know, I know that you two probably have some questions, but I want to close by saying that this is not a gender-neutral budget proposal. Women, you know, let's talk about healthcare, for example. Women are discriminated against in our current healthcare system. Women pay a particularly heavy price for broken healthcare. Even for those who have health insurance, women are more likely than men to have health coverage that has too many gaps, large copays, lifetime limits, the exclusion of needed services, and women who are worried about losing their jobs today are particularly at risk. You know, a personal note, my best friend from college, years ago she got breast cancer. She went through chemo. She beat it. A couple years ago, the breast cancer returned. She went through chemo. She beat it again. She works for a newspaper. She's a senior editor for a newspaper in Texas. The paper is being sold. If the paper is sold, she might be laid off and might lose her health care. And last week, she found out that the cancer has come back and it has spread to her liver.
Mm.
These are real life issues we're dealing with. Budget. You know, in Washington, D.C., you know, like I said before, your eyes might glaze over when you talk about the budget. But in Washington, D.C., money is policy. The budget is policy, and it affects real people. And that's why we have to learn about it, learn what to do, and act on it.
Well, one of the things to segue from that story you just told, she's fortunate that she had insurance the first two times, and her fear of losing it then, which is unfortunate in its whole for anyone, but what about the 43 million people who have no insurance at all?
Well, Jennifer, you're absolutely right, and we know from the stories that are coming into our office that some of them have cancer and will die because they cannot get access to adequate treatment. In this country, they will die because of a lack of access to health care. That, my friends, is barbaric.
Well, when we look for someone who's culpable in that situation, but it always turns back to insurance companies who work hardest to not pay for something than they do to see if they can cover something.
It's an incredibly complicated system. I'm with you. I want to put part of the blame on the insurance companies. I want to put part of the blame on the pharmaceutical companies. But I want to reserve the brunt of the blame for the overall incredibly complicated system itself. It's not like somebody went to work for the insurance industry or the pharmaceutical industry saying, oh, I'm going to go work here because, you know, I want these people to receive substandard care. They didn't do that. They went in there. They got sucked into the system. The system is inequitable and unfair, and we've got to reform the entire thing.
Absolutely. One other question that we talked about, you talked about first on that the budget had that the oil companies weren't happy with. What is it about the energy policy in the new budget that's pending that the oil companies dislike about it?
Their tax credits get taken away. You know, all of these great things that I outlined, we have to pay for them, right?
Right.
Well, we're going to pay for them in a couple of ways. First, we are going to restore the Bush tax cuts on the wealthiest 2% of all Americans. And I believe that would be individuals earning, I want to say $150,000 or more, or families filing jointly at $250,000 or more. And second, we are going to close corporate tax loopholes that allowed Exxon and other oil companies to make more money last year than they had made in the previous decade combined.
Yeah, due to the speculation in the oil market that ran it up to absolutely insane heights.
Right, and it's going to be a wicked, wicked fight, especially in the U.S. Senate.
Well, I'm wondering, and maybe you can answer this question, how are we going to get, we want green energy, we want to clean up the environment, we want to protect our planet from global warming, and how are we going to wean ourselves off of oil?
Well,
What's in that policy that you can tell me that's going to answer that question, if you can?
Well, remember that from crisis comes opportunity.
Oh, absolutely. I was here in 72 when we had an oil embargo.
Right, right.
And everybody promised us then we were going to wean ourselves off oil, and we were only importing a third of our oil then.
Right. And I don't have all of the answers for you right now, but I'll give you a few.
Okay.
We can pay to weatherize every government building. We can give tax incentives to give individual homeowners tax credits if they weatherize their own homes. Now, that's not a huge issue in Houston, although I don't know, maybe in the summer it
definitely
is.
Yes.
Yes.
We can require GM, Chrysler, Ford, if they're going to accept bailout money from us, they have to produce cars that are energy inefficient. I mean, energy efficient. Excuse me.
I got that. A little faux pas.
Right. We can do things like that. Remember, once again, money drives policy. If we incentivize GM, Detroit, all the car manufacturers to do something, to do certain things by offering tax credits and by showing them how they can make a profit if they do it this way, then we can give them a entrepreneurial, you know, private sector incentive to do it. Because it makes sense for them. It will allow them to make money, right? Everybody wants to make money.
Absolutely. One other thing, and that's, again, going back in history, one of the things that came out of the 72 oil embargo was a whole series of incentives for innovation. And not just innovation with the big three, which they didn't do, but incentives in the population, to the inventors, the creative instincts of Americans to find better ways of doing things. Is there any of that in this budget?
You know, I think there is, Jennifer. I'm not.
You haven't read it all?
Well,
I mean, yeah. How many pages is it? Come on.
Well, it came out last Thursday. It's more than 1,000 pages.
Okay, you're forgiven right now. Forgiven. But I laid that on the table because that was something I hear, like all of us hear, about talking about the big three, all the big corporations, when the most creative force in America is the individual entrepreneur or inventor who may come up with the next great invention.
Right, and it's small business. I mean, small business employs most people in this country.
Well, and they're the ones, a good idea, the growth of Silicon Valley, the growth of electronics was all based in those early inventions that, not the originals, because they did come, some of them did come from companies, but it was in research institutions, but the later ones, the refinements, came from individuals who made a lot of money and changed the face of electronics and media.
It's certainly true. And, you know, I would just really encourage everybody to pay attention to the budget fight that's coming up, because we really have the opportunity, if we are brave enough and courageous enough and innovative enough to seize it, we have the opportunity to turn crisis into opportunity and into growth for our economy. We can really build a future for our country and for the next generation if we're brave enough and insightful and courageous enough to seize it.
David, well, thank you very much for joining us this evening. And certainly you had a lot to talk about with... it's just really incredible. I mean, there's so many hoops we have to jump through that the Republicans have left us with in the past 8 years. And certainly Obama's trying, and the Congress is doing their job, too. But we've got a long way to go.
Well, Jack and Jennifer, thank you so much for having me tonight. And best wishes to everybody who's listening to Queer Voices.
And David, how can we contact you?
Well, my website is www.usaction.org. And, of course, you can always reach me at D as in David, Elliot, E-L-L-I-O-T, at usaction.org.
Great. Thank you very much, David.
Thank you, David.
I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
And I'm Lee Moore.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending February 28, 2009. An international statement condemning violence and discrimination based on sexual orientation failed to win approval this week by participating nations of the Durban Review Conference. It's being held in April in Geneva to assess the implementation of the Durban Declaration, established in 2001 at the United Nations World Conference Against Racism, Racial Discrimination, Xenophobia, and Related Intolerance. UNWatch.org reported support for the statement came from the European Union, New Zealand, the United States, and most of South America. But South Africa, on behalf of the African group, said that adding sexual orientation goes beyond the framework of the 2001 Durban Declaration. The United States' support of the 45-page document did contrast the administrations of George W. Bush and Barack Obama. The U.S. opposed a joint statement in December in the United Nations General Assembly that for the first time specifically addressed homophobia and LGBT rights. 66 of the 192 member countries, including the entire European Union, Brazil, Cuba, Central African Republic, Israel, and Japan, urged fellow member countries to decriminalize homosexuality. The U.S. joined China, Russia, and virtually every Arab nation in opposition at that time. The Vatican has opposed all global declarations in support of LGBT rights, including these two most recent efforts at the UN, because, Roman Catholic doctrine says, acting on same-gender attraction is a behavior and not an orientation.
Updating a story we reported 2 weeks ago, controversy continues at St. Mary's Roman Catholic Church in the Australian city of Brisbane. Father Peter Kennedy was fired by Archbishop John Bathersby for allowing women to preach and for vocally welcoming LGBT worshipers and blessing same-gender couples. Father Kennedy refuses to vacate the church as ordered, but agreed to meet with the Archdiocese after it proposed former High Court Judge Ian Callanan as a mediator, although details have not been disclosed. The so-called rebel priest told reporters that he expected up to 3,000 people at services on March 1st, some coming from considerable distance to show their support. Every bishop should put a parish under an edict, he said, because the place comes alive. It has further revitalized the community. It really has.
A Roman Catholic priest who also serves in the Brazilian Congress has been temporarily suspended from his priestly duties for supporting the free distribution of condoms to prevent the spread of AIDS. According to a report by the Associated Press, the Reverend Luiz Couto had ministered in the northeastern state of Paraíba. Archdiocese spokesman Eisenhower de Albuquerque said the church took the action because of Couto's public stance in favor of the use of condoms, his support of gay marriage, and his opposition to priestly celibacy. A spokesperson for Reverend Couteau said the priest is not a marriage equality advocate, but does oppose discrimination against homosexuals.
Raving homophobic U.S. pastor Fred Phelps and his daughter Shirley were banned from entering the United Kingdom last week. The God Hates Fags Klan from the tiny Westboro Baptist Church in Kansas had announced plans to picket a performance of The Laramie Project, a play about the gay-bashing murder of Wyoming college student Matthew Shepard at a school arts center in Basingstoke, Hampshire. Phelps and his small, mostly family followers infamously picketed Shepard's funeral with signs such as Matthew in Hell. Both these individuals have engaged in unacceptable behavior by inciting hatred against a number of communities, said a UK border agency spokesperson. We will continue to stop those who want to spread extremism, hatred, and violent messages in our communities from coming to our country. A single unidentified demonstrator did show up to picket the play, but the BBC reported that he was chased off by about 50 counter-protesters. The Phelps Klan also notoriously picket funerals of U.S. soldiers who have died in Iraq and Afghanistan because, they say, it's God's retribution for America's acceptance of homosexuality. They had threatened to come to Australia to demonstrate at memorials for those killed by the recent horrific bushfires, but didn't show up. They did make it to the Academy Awards in Hollywood. We'll have more about that during our wide-ranging Oscars coverage later in the program.
Elsewhere, a conservative Christian group has told a parliamentary inquiry in the Australian state of New South Wales that gays and lesbians are using children to pursue their so-called agenda. The Australian Christian Lobby told the Standing Committee of Law and Justice's inquiry into adoption by same-gender couples, not content with having discrimination removed, gays and lesbians are now pursuing symbolic gains and holding up children as trophies for their own agenda. Under current New South Wales state law, a single lesbian or gay person can adopt a child, but her or his partner is not legally recognized as the other parent.
A Jamaican lawmaker made headlines in the Caribbean country last week by claiming that the police force has been overrun by homosexuals. Under pressure from his Jamaican Labour Party, MP Ernest Smith apologized for that charge, but stood by his other comments that the nation's leading LGBT rights group, the Jamaica Forum for Lesbians, All Sexuals and Gays, should be outlawed.
It seems to be increasingly more of a political risk these days to make offensively homophobic comments in the United States, however. Utah Republican State Senator Chris Butters was removed from two committee chairmanships by his embarrassed party after making inflammatory comments to a documentary filmmaker. He called gays and lesbians immoral, the greatest threat to America, and compared them to Muslim extremists. Sodom and Gomorrah was localized, he said. This is worldwide. A series of five LGBT rights-related measures were, nevertheless, all defeated in the GOP-dominated Utah Senate last week.
But a Colorado lawmaker's comments equating gays and lesbians with murderers did not derail passage of a domestic partners bill in that state's Senate this week. The measure would provide limited rights to registered couples, whether same gender or heterosexual, to share health benefits, make medical decisions for an incapacitated partner, and to leave property to a partner. During debate on the bill, Republican State Senator Scott Renfro quoted from the Bible and called homosexuality an offense to God. "We are taking sins and making them to be legally okay. That is wrong," he said. "I'm not saying this is the only sin out there. We have murder. We don't make laws making murder legal." There were no reports that fellow Republicans had taken any disciplinary action against Renfro for his remarks, although human rights groups and other lawmakers condemned them, including Colorado's first openly lesbi-gay state senator, Democrat Jennifer Viega, who sponsored the bill. During debate, Democratic Senate Majority Leader Brandon Schaefer called the fair treatment of gay and lesbian citizens the civil rights issue of our day. A similar bill has already passed in the state House. The two bills must now be reconciled and gain final approval in both legislative bodies. Renfro told the Greeley Tribune this week that, "I apologize if my use of words did upset people, I guess. I probably could have been more eloquent."
New Mexico's state Senate rejected a similar domestic partner registry this week. 10 Democrats joined all 15 Republicans to defeat the measure by a 25-17 vote. Continuing to blur the separation of church and state mandated by the U.S. Constitution, Roman Catholic bishops in New Mexico had urged their congregations to lobby senators to oppose the bill.
A bill to add gays and lesbians to the state's Human Rights Act, sponsored by Indiana's only openly lesbi-gay lawmaker Nicole LeFevre, was defeated in a state Senate committee this week. Republican Senator Russ Fulcher told the committee that, "I'm not interested in giving special rights based on behavior." LeFevre, who reportedly left the hearing in tears, has vowed to try again next year.
A Hawaii Senate committee deadlocked 3-3 this week on a civil unions bill that would grant virtually all the state rights of marriage, except the name, to same-gender couples. But a rarely invoked provision of the Hawaii Constitution can force a full Senate vote if more than one-third of its members approve. At least 18 of the state's 25 senators are on record in support of the bill. It's already passed in the state House, but Republican Governor Linda Lingle, whose signature would be required to make the bill law, has not stated her position on the measure.
And finally, a Scottish lesbian couple will be given fertility treatment by a National Health Service office in Glasgow after they sued the local health authority for denying services to them. Caroline Harris and Julie McMullen had asked the Court of Session in Edinburgh for £20,000 in compensation. A consultant told them last July that they did not fit the criteria for IVF services because they are biologically incapable of conceiving and therefore would not be eligible for NHS-funded treatment. The health board denied that it had discriminated on the basis of sexual orientation, but issued a statement this week acknowledging the recent passage of the UK Human Fertilisation and Embryology Act 2008 and Equality Act Sexual Orientation Regulations 2007. The board said, in part, that it had reconsidered its position and has now decided to offer treatment to this couple.
That's News Wrap for the week ending February 28, 2009. Written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Lee Moore.
And I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
This is Queer Voices.
And before we get to Jennifer to talk about Lobby Day, I just want to mention a few things. One is that our webpage, queervoices.org, is up to date with the schedule for this week. And you can also get us on Facebook.
That's right.
And
join the group on Facebook, and we have updated schedules every week and all kinds of little tidbits.
And we're also on Twitter, Queer Voices. So if you want to ask a question, that's probably the best way to do it, is just tweet us, Queer Voices. Jennifer, when did you go to Austin?
I left yesterday around noon, Sunday at noon, and I drove up to Austin. The first event was at 5:30. So I wanted to get up there, get into the hotel, and be ready for the first event. There was a reception at the hotel for a number of anybody in the hotel. It was sort of a get-together. Everyone get to meet one another who might be in the hotel or coming over to the hotel. I did meet a number of people who weren't staying at the DoubleTree, which was the headquarters of the event, who came over just to be part of that. It was just marvelous. There was a large room, but we were packed in shoulder to shoulder.
Well, just giving a little bit of history, we had a march in Washington in 1987, and then in 1989, which is in Texas, the legislature meets every odd year unless it's a special session. There has been a march for a number of these every other year things starting in 1989, and then Equality Texas, which was originally the lobby lesbian gay rights lobby of Texas, I guess decided it would make more sense to have Lobby Day, although they did both for a time, than to have a march, because Lobby Day, they said, felt would be more efficient to get to move the agenda up.
Oh, absolutely. And part of that history is that along a similar path, there was a transgender lobby day.
Yes.
And this was during that time of struggle to be the, for the transgender community to be included in the GLB community. And so last session was the first time under the sponsorship of Equality Texas to have a totally inclusive lobby day, which was entirely for the GLBT community.
So, you met on Sunday night to sort of...
Sunday night, it was a lot of rah-rah, you know, get everybody pumped up for today. But what was really great, we had nine state representatives from various districts there to support us and to speak. Anise Parker was there to support us. It was a wonderful scene, and what was really interesting and an observation was the crowd was interesting. Approximately 500. The exact number I don't have, but it was greater than 435 because that's when they cut off registration. And this morning when I went by to pick up my packet, they didn't have me registered. And I was one of the first registered, which meant that I had to register then. And I was in a group of 70 or 80 people who came this morning.
Do you think most of those people were from urban areas, or do you think there were some people from non-urban areas?
Most of who was in line, because I got to visit, because I took some time to do a few interviews, quick statements from people. I was only able to get edited for this show two of them, but they were examples of what I got. They were young. They were in their 20s. They were either skipping school or taking time out of their school day and just not showing up. There were some young professionals who had just skipped work today, called in sick, so that they could be part of it. It was a growing groundswell based on hearing how large this was going to be and wanting to be part of something special.
Interesting. So it's incredible, all those people that were there. So you got your packet, and then what did you do?
As soon as we got the packet, we went over to the steps of the Capitol, where we had a couple of speeches, and there was a press conference, and we had our group picture taken. Last year, when there was about 280 people there, it was easy for one camera in one shot to take all of us. Well, this year that was impossible. There was just too many of us, and which only showed the growth of it. And something to point out at this point, with the crowd, it was last year it was GLBT people. This year was not only GLBT, but PFLAG was there. Our supporters and friends were there. Our straight allies participated, so that when we went up to the different legislators, it was a group of individuals that came from all aspects of our community, plus our supporters and our friends.
Interesting. So after the steps, being on the steps, what was...
We went. We had to split up. There were so many of us. We split up into two groups to go over training for the lobby day, also to coach us as to what to say, what not to say, basically. That many of us, me included, we were going to legislators who have not supported any of our issues, who absolutely resist anything GLBT or fairness or equality on the surface. So those who had to face is how to handle them and their staffs, because a lot of times their staff will just be just as opinionated as possibly the legislator is. And once that's done, that took about an hour. We all got in our groups. There were over 80 separate groups that went out.
Wow.
And to visit the legislators. Each group had two House representatives and one senator to see in the morning. And we all set out to do that. I was speaking to my own. Tom Craddock was one of mine.
and Representative John Smithy. And Smithy was, it was rather appropriate I got Smithy because last session, Smithy chairs the insurance committee. And last session, I went up there to to speak and witness at the committee on one of the pieces of legislation, one of the ones we're has been resubmitted. He delayed our presentation so long that I eventually got up there at 1:30 in the morning, and I had been there since about 1:30 earlier in the day. So we went there, we went to lunch, and after lunch we went to our own specific representative and our senator. It gave us, as citizens, we went in there to see them. Unfortunately, for me and a lot of other people, we didn't necessarily get to see the legislator, especially the ones, you know, like Craddock wasn't there. Dan Patrick wasn't there. Matter of fact, Dan Patrick wasn't even in the city. Little word of that. Anyway, those people who aren't our friends usually, we're not going to be there anyway. Our friends,
Garnet Coleman,
Ellen Cohen,
Jessica Grant.
Oh yeah, all of our friends. They were there. Matter of fact, they held open houses for us to come in for snacks and the like. For it, they were there and supportive, and were sitting there waiting for us to come. I think it was interesting, and I want to play one of my clips, and that is what we saw in the group. Of the number, over a third were first-timers who had never gone to a lobby day of any kind. And of that number, the largest portion of them were young people, the 20-somethings. And I grabbed one 20-something, 22-year-old, and just asked him about it. If you'll play track one.
This is Jennifer Renee. We're at Lobby Day in Austin.
My name is Austin Healy, and I'm from Austin, Texas.
Austin, is this your first time to a lobby day?
It is my first time.
Well, what is your experience? How do you feel about it?
So far, so good. Most of the aides are friendly, getting our point across. Just overall pretty well so far.
Have you had any bad experiences, or have they been all good?
All good so far. You know, even the people that really don't show that much support for, you know, our community have been pretty friendly, surprisingly. So, you know, as you knew from earlier, pretty good so far.
Would you like to come back? Are you planning to come back next year or next session, I mean?
Absolutely. I will be here.
Well, that was sort of a sample. What we found were that those people that aren't usually friendly, their staff, by and large, were fairly friendly. Found one in Smithy's office. I won't mention her name. She didn't want me to because it might cost her a job. She was so supportive, and she was going to make sure that the information got to him and be presented in the way we presented it to her from a more favorable position.
Now, what are the bills that you were trying to...
Well, I'll quickly go over. There were six of them we talked about, and two that I want to talk about briefly were House Bill 197, which is about insurance. And this is the one I mentioned that in Smithy's committee, which is about adding sexual orientation and gender identity expression to the insurance bill so that you cannot be denied any form of insurance for those reasons. Also, the insurance bill was to cover so that domestic partners have the right to go into the hospitals and all where there's covered. That's House Bill 353. One that's a special favorite of mine and passionate about is House Bill 538. 538 is basically the Texas INDA. It's non-discrimination where Texas really doesn't have it as basic. That's what that one's for. Then House Bill 616 is authorization to study the hate crimes bill in why is it that since it was passed, it has not been used to the extent where only 8, 9 have ever been tried under hate crimes, and 8 were convicted. So that many of the legislators aren't doing it. Another quick one is the Bill 1323, which is the bullying, anti-bullying, which includes cyberbullying, which is something that didn't occur in the past. And then House Bill 861, which is to allow the University of Texas system, as well as Texas A&M system, to provide domestic partnership provisions and protections and for health insurance and all. Both institutions have said they would do it, but they can't do it under current Texas law.
That's great. And you have this booklet that they handed out there that basically has all the information mm-hmm. when you go to lobby. And, of course, if you want to get some more information, you can go to EqualityTexas.org.
Absolutely. I have one quick little statement from Randall Terrell I'd like to play real quickly, and it's on track 2.
Hey there, my name is Randall Terrell. I'm the political director for Equality Texas. I'm originally from Stephenville, Texas, but I've been living in Austin for the last couple of decades.
Well, Randall, tell me about it. The lobby day's winding up now. We're at the end in the auditorium. Tell me how you felt about today.
Oh, it's been fantastic. I'm usually up here just as the lobbyist, and it seems kind of lonely at times. But we've had 400-plus folks come up here to lobby. We've had 80 teams of lobbyists going around making multiple visits to the state rep's office and senator's office. And it's been a fantastic success. We've had a dominant presence up here at the Capitol this session. It's been a lot of fun.
Do you think our presence being here in the numbers that were there is really going to affect or change some minds?
Oh, I think it has to. I think we've done a number of visits. I've already been told of probably a half dozen visits with people who you would normally not think would be supportive politicians who seem to be interested in working with us on issues, and I'm thrilled by that.
Thank you very much. See, I mean, it was great. I was awestruck by what we did, just so passionate, the people that were there. I think we did make a difference. This was the largest number. The legislature knew that over 500 GLBT's people and their supporters were there, and I think it made a difference.
That's great. And next week we are planning to have Paul Scott on in this segment from Equality Texas to give us sort of an update of what he saw happening at Lobby Day. Jennifer, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Queer Voices. Some way, whoa, I'll meet him.
2003. That was Erasure, Walking in the Rain. And coming up next on Queer Voices, the Gay Men's Chorus of Houston and their tribute to the best of the New York theater scene. At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Valensky and the entire Queer Voices crew.
Second hour, we're kind of focusing on music, and that is, of course, Houston's own Gay Men's Chorus. And in the studio tonight is the lovely Colleen Fisher. Hello, Colleen.
Hello, good evening.
And also, we have a special guest, J.D. Doyle. And
Brian just grabbed me off the street.
I did. I drove up to the Woodlands, and I said, J.D., you need to come down here and do a show once in a while.
I just happen to have tomorrow off, so it'll work out.
There you go.
I was so excited when I found out J.D. was going to be interviewing me with Brian.
I mean, this is a perfect kind of musical segment with J.D. here. Kind of
absolutely.
Putting his stamp of excellence on
stamp,
it.
Stamp of whatever.
Exactly.
Cynicism.
Okay, we were listening to the Gay Men's Chorus, and I understand there's a concert coming up.
There is. St. Patrick's Day makes it easy to remember. We will be performing at Jones Hall. We've got the Chorale performing for the first half of the concert in their second standalone performance.
And the Chorale is for our audience members that may not know?
Yes, is our mixed chorus. So it has both men and women. When the Bayou City Women's Chorus and Gay Men's Chorus get together, they form the Bayou City Chorale.
So how many people are corralled there?
About 125.
Okay.
Yeah. So the risers are going to be packed, and we're really excited because the piece that we're doing has allowed us to collaborate with a couple different groups. So we're going to be joined on stage by the 70-piece Doctors Orchestra of Houston, which
good
is going
to
be outstanding accompaniment.
No room for an audience, I guess.
No, there's always room for an audience. And then we're going to have narration provided by the fabulous Annalee Jeffries.
What was the title of this event?
The song of the show is called Songs of Wisdom from the Old Turtle, which is based on the children's book, the award-winning children's book, and it's been set to music, and it's incredible. In the second half of the show, the guys are going to be singing the best of Broadway. So,
woohoo!
I know, exactly. Break
look out. Look out, Brian.
Oh, my God. That makes my little gay heart flutter.
The dance and everything. It's going to be fantastic. You've got some great choreography.
Tell us more about
old
the music.
Broadway, new exactly. Broadway, what?
This is kind of a mix, mostly new Broadway, but there's definitely a mix of some older pieces in there, some older shows that have been revived, like Dreamgirls. Mm-hmm. So we're going to have some great pieces from Dreamgirls.
About Chicago?
Actually, nothing from Chicago, if I remember correctly. But we've got some great stuff from Avenue Q.
Oh, yeah.
I think you said Rent.
Rent, yes.
Oh, Rent.
I was talking
it's
about
Wicked.
Rent earlier. Wicked. Yep. We're doing Defying Gravity from Wicked.
Oh,
of course.
My God. Okay. Gonna,
and they were singing tonight. They sound amazing. I'm
Do
so
they?
Excited. Absolutely.
Ooh,
they sound
too.
Great. So it's going to be an absolute showstopper of a night. And in fact, the piece we were listening to as we came in, the guys are also going to be performing bits from the show at AIDS Walk on March 15th.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So if, you
is
know,
that
anyone.
The opening ceremony?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
So get there early.
Exactly. Get there early, listen to the guys sing, and through the whole opening ceremony. It's going to be an awesome day from start to finish. You know, AIDS Walk is an incredible event for Houston, and we're really lucky to be
here.
We're
going to have them on next week to talk about that.
AIDS Great. Walk. Perfect. Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. So it's good. So the piece we're listening to was For the Fallen, which the guys, it's one of their standard pieces that they do in remembrance and memory.
So if our listeners are kind of intrigued, where can they get tickets?
Just hop onto our website, which is www.BayouCityPerformingArts.org, and it'll have all of the information that you need. We've got our new website's been up since September, and so it's pretty easy to navigate and head on through and find your tickets and get things ordered either online, or if you'd like, you can also call our office at 713-521-7464.
BayouCityPerformingArts.org.
That's a long one.
It is a long one. And let me tell you, it's always interesting to put it in the marketing pieces. You're always squeezing it together to try to get enough room.
Now, if people want to show up the night of the show, what time should they get there?
The box office will open at 6:30.
6:30, okay.
Yep. And so you can get your tickets the night of the show, but to get the best seats, we want to make sure that you get the best seats possible, so it's usually better to give us a call. And we can just put them in will call for you and make it real easy to pick up.
Yeah.
Exactly.
How old is the chorus now?
Chorus is 30.
Wow, this year?
Absolutely.
Are you going to do a special CD release for that?
We're thinking about it. We absolutely are. James has some great
greatest
pieces.
Hits or something?
Perhaps. I don't really know if that's what's going to happen with all that, but we would love to do something.
And the CDs are available on the website.
Yes. Everything's available on the website. There's nothing you can't get off of the website.
Now, I've heard that James is moving on.
He is. James has...
James Knapp.
Yes.
James
Knapp,
sorry. Yes, our artistic director. He has been conducting the chorus now for 8 years. As
great job.
Season, exactly.
We love you, James.
And his partner has been given a really incredible opportunity to move back to the Northeast. Partner's from the Northeast. Uh-huh. James is from the Western New York area. And so he's going to be moving back up to the Northeast to be with his partner. And there's a moment where you want to pause and just take stock of the fact that, you know, he's really built this organization up
absolutely.
Over the last 8 years, and we owe a lot to what he's been able to dream and build.
I've watched the quality improve every year, year after year.
And we are so lucky to have him at the helm. The really incredible thing is that it's going to allow for new people mm-hmm. to come in the board is incredibly smart, and they're doing a wonderful job at securing our replacements. And they're going to do an absolutely fantastic job at finding someone who believes as much in this chorus as James does and will do the same outstanding job that he has done. And you know what? Bring something new to the table and give audiences something to come back for and to see again.
Time to evolve, maybe.
Many cities have, like, guest stars, like Michael Feinstein or
sure.
somebody with the chorus.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is that being considered? Or?
We can't do it this season because everything's been slated.
Right.
Like our next big show in June is La Perla, and that's a huge commission of Hispanic music, which we're really excited about. But as for guest artist work, it's absolutely in the works. It's in the plans, and we hope that we can bring those guest artists as soon as possible.
Mm-hmm. So. I get the quarterly magazine from the Seattle chorus.
Yes,
they
Seattle.
Are wonderful, and they always have somebody dazzling, like
Debbie Reynolds. Yes,
is booked, and they've had Leslie Gore do a girl group show.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always inspired work.
It is incredibly inspired work, and Dennis is an unbelievable artistic director, and James works with Dennis a lot for ideas. In fact, Seattle's working with us on La Perla, mm-hmm. which is great. They're one of our co-commissioning choruses.
And they've got Eric Lane Barnes and
they do. They have a tremendous staff, right. and we learn a lot, and we take a lot from them, and we love to share and collaborate with them, and it just makes for incredible performances and you know contemporary music for a choral audience, which is great. Something that nobody else in Houston really offers.
I've forgotten the website already. Can you help me on that?
BayouCityPerformingArts.org. Nice segue.
Now, if there's anyone out there that hasn't attended a concert, I highly recommend that this St. Patrick's Day, you go out to Jonestown.
Wear green.
Wear green. I mean, make it a festive occasion.
Absolutely. Know? Come on out.
I mean, you can hear the chorale, the first part, and then the second part, of course, is the Broadway, which, you know, you had me at Buh.
Exactly. Buh. It's all about the Big Apple.
Yes. And tickets are available on the website or at the box office the night of, starting
night
at 6:30.
Or call the office at 713-521-7464.
Colleen. On the way into the interview here, we heard a little bit of a song that's called For the Fallen from the Mosaic CD that you guys put out. You want to say a little bit about that, and then we'll hear the rest of it on the way out.
Yeah, absolutely. Just For the Fallen is just to the memory of all those friends and partners and loved ones that, you know, we've lost to AIDS. And this goes out to all of our friends and families who are either with us or are thinking of those loved ones at this time of year. And, you know, this is for AIDS Walk and in memory of all those friends. Folks, thank you so much.
They shall grow not old as we that are left grow old. Age shall not weary them, nor the make my bed. I'm a conspiracy.
I wait for news. It never seems too good. If Christ showed up, the government would likely buy the wood. Now there's a conspiracy. There's a conspiracy. 'Cause they trash the poor and they make damn sure they blame bureaucracy. It's a conspiracy. It's a conspiracy. 'Cause they promise anything they like and they wait for the stampede. It's a conspiracy. It's a conspiracy. Thank God my pills are waiting on my nightstand for me. It's a conspiracy. It's a conspiracy. But don't you fret, 'cause I'll just bet you're on the sign up sheet for the conspiracy, yeah.
This is J.D. Doyle, and that was Andy Northrup with Conspiracy from his debut album, Slow Burn Avenue. And Andy is in the studio with us all the way from Edmonton, Alberta.
From the Great White North.
Hi, guys. How you doing?
And, you know, it's got to be a special artist to get me down from the Woodlands to do a live interview.
Exactly. That was a great song.
I popped this out all of a sudden on J.D. the other day. I only found out I was going to be in Houston a couple of days ago, and I popped this on him, and he said, well, I suppose we could do dinner, but I suppose you want to do radio, too.
Yeah.
J.D. is gay radio in Houston.
And I wanted Andy to bring his guitar, but it's just too much trouble getting it through customs and so forth.
Right.
Tell us about that.
Well, it's just because within customs, they want to know if you have a work permit. They want to know if you're getting paid. As a Canadian artist coming down to the States, it's very difficult to come down. And frankly, you know, you don't want to cause yourself confusion or frustration.
Yeah, I was just thinking from the angle, I'm afraid to travel with the instrument. I don't want it damaged.
Well, Air Canada destroyed one of my favorite Fender guitars. So believe me, I'm suspect to let any airline get their hands on my guitar.
I guess Celine Dion messed it up for you.
Oh, whatever.
Coming down here and stealing all that, bringing all that Canadian music.
One reviewer wrote about you. He's Bruce Springsteen with fag on his t-shirt.
Oh, that made me laugh. Can you imagine what Bruce would have thought if he had heard that? The other was Bob Dylan with a shrunken hypothalamus.
So that leads up to, is it important for you to be out as an artist?
I think it's important to be out as a person.
Oh,
that's exactly
call.
The way you answered that when I asked you that question 7 years ago.
Yeah. That means that he believes it and doesn't even think about it. He just says it.
Well, no, and frankly, I don't think I'd be much of an artist. How honest would I be, and how valid would my art be if I wasn't honest about who I am and what I am? The fact remains is that it doesn't govern everything I write, but certainly when it comes up and when the subject matter is when it's necessary in the subject matter, I don't even think about it.
He sent me an email however many years ago, saying, can I send you my CD? Yeah.
Well, I didn't know.
And I've had him on Audiophile twice now.
Exactly.
And on Queer Music Heritage. In fact, he was the anchor interview on my Bear music special a couple years ago.
Bear, B-A-R-E?
B-E-A-R, oh. All right.
Oh, I see.
You're thinking of Broadway Bear or something.
Yes, yeah. I'm still kind of... Remember
but Andy, also an actor. Tell us just a bit about that.
Well, I got started back in the arts. I left it for 10 years. At 29, I realized I wasn't going to feel alive till I got creative again. I started to write tunes. A friend of mine came in and demoed a song for me. He ended up playing it for a playwright who asked me to write a musical for him. I ended up sound designing shows, writing musicals. Then a friend of mine was stuck for a role and asked me if I'd read for them. And he ended up casting me. And ever since then, I've just done films and plays and got cast a lot.
And traveled all over the country doing
so? Yeah, all over North America, right. Which is really cool. We just finished doing a production of Hamlet for Walter Dale Theater for their 50th anniversary in Edmonton. And we closed on Saturday night. I was playing Claudius.
And you're all grizzly bear.
Well, what can I say?
Grizzly beard.
Lots of gray hair. I look pretty mountain manny.
How would you compare the creativity you need as a singer-songwriter to that as an actor?
Actually, you know what? It's all about getting to an honest place and being able to convey that honestly to an audience, regardless of whether it's from the perspective of a script or a song that you've written. It's pretty, it's awfully naked to be up there with a guitar sitting at a piano delivering a tune that you've written, though.
It's your material. You're
yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. You can't blame it on the
poorly written Shakespearean material.
It's Shakespeare's fault.
That was with my director. My director's favorite quote was, take it up with the playwright.
Right.
Okay, thanks. I'll do that.
Okay, it's been 9 years since you released your first CD. I'll say the hard question here.
Yeah.
Okay, what has been the most surprising thing you've learned during your musical journey since then?
Oh, my God, that's a good question.
The most surprising thing that I've learned is that more people than I expected took it seriously. And also that... it's also really difficult within the gay community to be acknowledged as anything other than, like, if you're not doing a form of music that, like, the women tend to concentrate on their own artists, and the men see singer-songwriters as cliche and often don't give you the time of day, but then there's people like you, JD, in the world who make it their modus operandi to get out there and inform people, and that's why I think I've garnered as much of an audience in America as I have, is because of people like you, and I'm grateful.
Well, you've also found your niche in the bear music community, though.
Yeah, well, actually, they've been really open to singer-songwriter stuff, and frankly, they've been really welcoming. Freddie Freeman and Michael West and people like that.
You're talking about the Bearapalooza events that have been in a number of cities.
Right, I've played New York, Seattle, Nashville. Milwaukee. We're going to do Milwaukee Pride again this year. Bunch of places.
Is there an overall message to your music?
Yeah, just that we should really learn to respect each other and hold each other up, because we need the support to get through it all.
Any questions, Brian?
How did you get started in music?
To my mind, as a kid, my album collection was my best friend. Songwriters spoke to me with an honesty that I couldn't expect or didn't really anticipate from any other avenue. And I just felt like those songwriters were the people I could expect to really give me the straight goods without coloring it. And so everything from metal to singer-songwriter to introspective stuff to jazz, depending on who my friends were visiting that day, they saw what section of albums were at the front of the pile. But I just realized that as a writer, I wanted to aspire to that. And I threw all my stuff away at about 18 or 19 because I thought it was navel-gazing garbage. And then I gave it up for 10 years, and I didn't get back to being creative till I was 29.
Well, I think our issue as a community is there's not this huge gay music repository of kind of from back 30 years ago. So it just kind of all started at day zero, it seems like. And JD's done a lot of work in trying to bring that out to...
It pretty much started the early 70s.
Yeah, I mean, 30 years ago, and mm-hmm. So...
But there was a little around the Stonewall time, wasn't there?
Not too much,
yeah.
No.
It's like a lot of...
No, as far as openly gay material by openly gay and lesbian artists... Not really until, 73.
Yeah, exactly.
The women's music movement.
And see, that's just it. You gotta give the women props, because they were the first to stand up.
Light years ahead.
They were the first to stand up.
Well, they had to, because they were their own minority group that they had to build. They had to get support. They had to nurture each other. They were not only lesbians, they were women, so they were already trying to break through a lot of doors, and they had to build their community.
Doubly oppressed, it's right.
Yeah, and they were mm-hmm. diminished by gay men as well.
I think they still are today.
Yeah.
There you go.
I mean, does your partner ever worry about you writing songs about him?
He knows I have, and the ones that I have that apply directly to him or indirectly to him, he's aware of. It's just that I don't advertise it. People let people draw their own conclusions. I'm very open about my own experiences. I'm not so forward with coming, being forthcoming about songs about people that I'm close to, because that's not fair to them.
Right. How long have y'all been together?
It'll be 15 years in August.
15 years, wow.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
It is awesome. I'm grateful for
that's
him
like
every
50
day.
Years in straight time.
He would tell you it's probably like 500.
Oh.
Okay, and you've got a website, I guess?
AndyNorthrup.com.
A little slower. Slow down.
Sorry. AndyNorthrup.com.
This is the South. We talk a little slower. Okay. Understand a little slower.
AndyNorthrup.
And you can find both of his CDs there. We're going to close out with a song from the second one, Cardboard Logic, and the song is my favorite track of Andy's called It Ain't Easy.
Think it's easy. You think it's plain. You think this frown upon my face implies the faggot knows his place, and it's that easy. Think it's easy. It's in the plan. You tend to hide the way you hate. I represent the reprobates, and it's that easy. But the world is changing faster than you know. I can sense your consternation as it grows. You deny the history of who I am, taking comfort in the fact that you'll see me damned to spend eternity in darkness and in fear. Cause it ain't easy. You're too afraid. To take some ownership and try to find a way to compromise. Cause it ain't easy. You can't see what kind of monster you've become. You don't understand that love is all you've shunned. You're avoiding lessons learned in days gone by. Paranoid perpetuation of the lies about the nature of the beast that you see in me. In this world of doubt, in this world of seeing, you waste your time obsessed with me. It should be easy. It should be plain. But though you speak of higher love, it's up to me to rise above. And it ain't easy.
That was Canadian singer and songwriter Andy Northrup, who appeared live in the studio to be interviewed by J.D. And coming up next on Queer Voices, the Houston Pride Band.
Continuing on with our musical hour, we have the Houston Pride Band just featured with Rudy in the studio tonight. How are you?
I'm doing good. How about you two?
We're doing great. And, of course, we still have JD in here.
JD, stick around.
Sticking around. We have a concert coming up, I understand.
Yes, sir, we do. It's the Houston Pride Band Winter Spring Concert titled Best of All Possible World. It's going to be held this Saturday at 7:30 p.m., and it's benefiting AIDS Foundation Houston, kind of to tie in with the AIDS Walk coming up.
And where is it going to be held?
It's going to be held at Resurrection MCC at the corner of 11th Street and T.C. Jester in the Heights.
Mm-hmm. And tickets are available online, or how can we get tickets?
Yes, you can go online at www.houstonprideband.org, or you can contact 713-892-9491, and of course, they'll be available at the door, and doors do open at 7 o'clock.
Now, tell us a little bit about what we may hear if we attend this concert.
Well, the music that we're playing this season, the theme is called Beyond Fences, Music Without Borders. So we're showcasing a lot of music and composers from around the world. To give you an example for this concert, Rimsky-Korsakov's Concerto for Trombone and Band featuring Noel Freeman on trombone.
Noel Freeman?
Noel Freeman.
He plays trombone.
He plays trombone.
He's running for political office.
He plays trombone in our band.
Oh, wow. Small world. Sorry.
As well as Alfred Reed's Dance Caribbean. And, of course, the piece of resistance in this particular concert and how we got the name of the concert, Best of All Possible World, is Leonard Bernstein's Candide Suite, which is a French satire by Voltaire. Best of All Possible World is a movement from that suite.
Very good. Now, are y'all doing anything for AIDS Walk? You said that you were benefiting AIDS Foundation Houston.
Yeah, we're for the concert. Concert ticket proceeds will be going to AIDS Foundation Houston. The band will also be performing at the AIDS Walk on that following Sunday, the 15th.
Right.
We'll be playing on the sidelines.
Of March. Yeah, it's coming up.
Yep. We'll be playing on the sidelines. If you're walking, feel free to stop by and say hello. Last year, Mayor Bill White stopped by and said hello, and he was as close to me as you are right now.
I always, when I do the AIDS Walk, I always look for the band, and I always enjoy it. Are y'all performing any, like, marching, walking songs to get everybody going?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, the pieces haven't been handed out yet. It's going to be something we can put together pretty quickly, but it's going to be some very fun marches, as well as one really fun piece.
You're not going to tell our listeners, are you?
No, I don't want to give it away just yet.
Oh, my gosh.
Come down to the AIDS Walk and find out for yourself.
Absolutely. Now, Rudy, we've spoken before on the program about joining the band, if you're so musically inclined, but if there's someone out there listening that wants to exercise their musical muscle, how would they
And go? What level of ability would be considered?
Well, I will tell you right now, when I joined the band, it had been close to 15 years since I had picked up my clarinet, which I play clarinet in the band. We take all level of musicianship, and we're open to gay, lesbians, bisexual, transgenders, GLBT community. We're open to as well as the heterosexual community. Feel free to come join us. Our rehearsals are on Wednesdays at 7:30 in the evening, every Wednesday evening at Resurrection MCC, again at 11th and T.C. Jester.
How many members are there right now?
Currently, we're between 30 and 40, which is an upswing of what we've seen, and it's a really strong, strong band that we're forming.
Does that allow you to do different work?
Yes, it does, actually. We have people who are doing different pieces like within the band with regards to percussion, and sometimes they play guitar and other things like that.
I mean, bigger, broader pieces than the band might have attempted before.
Right. Our artistic director, Jason Stevens, has brought a lot of diversity to our band, and he's bringing a lot more of the classical pieces as opposed to more of the pop pieces, although we're hoping to return to some of the pop pieces here soon as well.
I see notes here about a silent auction.
Yes, we're extremely excited about this. This is a silent auction and raffle. The ticket proceeds from the silent auction and raffle will benefit Houston Pride Band. The silent auction, there's going to be the opportunity to bid for an RSVP Mexican Riviera cruise with an ocean view cabin that's going to take place in April of this year.
And this is at this Saturday's concert.
If you've got to go to the Caribbean, go to the Mexican Caribbean.
Well, see, there you go. It kind of goes with Alfred Reed's Dance of Caribbean. So, you know, we're doing the Caribbean. We're doing this whole, you know, feeling of getting out there and doing things in the Caribbean. As well, in the raffle, we're providing tickets for two on Continental Airlines anywhere in the contiguous 48 states.
Oh, my gosh.
In Mexico, Canada, Alaska, the Caribbean, Central America. Tickets are available, will be available there at the concert.
And what other things do you have in the silent auction?
There's going to be a Pineapple Point Resort weekend in Fort Lauderdale.
Concierge Travel is coming through.
Yes. Once again, we've partnered with them, and they've been great with us, as well as many different smaller items, artwork, gift packages. You name it. Our last year was very very popular and very successful, and we brought it back again this year.
So the silent auction alone is reason to attend the concert. I mean, the music is just a bonus.
Exactly. It always is.
What else you got coming up?
Well, we have, aside from performing for AIDS Walk Houston, we're also going to have a free family concert at Discovery Green in April.
Oh.
And we're going to be a part of their summer series of music. Something we're really excited about.
Is that the first time that you performed at Discovery Green?
Yes.
That would be very nice.
It's going to be a lot of fun, as well as our season finale concert in June that we're going to hold at the Hobby Center. Once again, it's going to be the weekend before Pride.
So is it going to be like a Pride tie-in type event?
Not direct ties, but certainly it's a great kickoff to the Pride festivities.
Absolutely.
Let's recap the main event coming up.
Yes, sir. We are having a concert. That's a Houston Pride Band concert benefiting the AIDS Foundation Houston, with a silent auction and raffle come out, and with a possibility to win an RSVP Mexican Riviera cruise, as well as two Continental airline tickets. It's going to be this Saturday, March 7th at 7:30 p.m. at Resurrection MCC on 11th Street at TC Jester in the Heights.
I wonder if you have a website.
We do. It is www.houstonprideband.org, and you can also buy tickets for the concert there and find out more information.
Everybody I ask that question just comes up with an answer.
It seems like they had kind of that in the back of their mind, maybe. I don't know. It's a great website. I've seen it. Very good. So,
do you have any CDs?
We have CDs available that we distribute among the band members, but not any to the general public. Copyrights.
Sounds like
collector's items, aren't they?
And we are going back into the music from the Houston Pride Band. Rudy, thank you for coming out.
Thank you very much.
Every actor worth his salt strives to be honest and true in his portrayals on the stage or screen. Hello, this is Ian McKellen, and that's exactly what this Ray Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine, does as well, right here on this station.
How did he do it? Fellow Best Actor Oscar winner Robert De Niro asked in his profile of this year's winner, Sean Penn, during the 81st Annual Academy Awards on February 22nd. How for so many years, De Niro continued, did he get all those jobs playing straight men? Penn won the trophy in a highly competitive field for his moving portrayal of assassinated gay San Francisco supervisor Harvey Milk in the critically acclaimed film directed by openly gay nominee Gus Van Sant. And the Best Original Screenplay Oscar went to first-time nominee and openly gay writer Dustin Lance Black. Both winners talked politics in their acceptance speeches and with the press backstage. Black fought back tears as he thanked the Academy for honoring his work.
Oh my God, this was not an easy film to make. And first off, I have to thank Cleve Jones and Ann Cronenberg and all the real life people who shared their stories with me. And Gus Van Sant, Sean Penn, Emil Hirsch, Josh Brolin, James Franco, and our entire cast, my producers, Dan Jinks and Bruce Cohen, everyone at Groundswell and Focus, for taking on the challenge of telling this life-saving story. When I was 13 years old, my beautiful mother and my father moved me from a conservative Mormon home in San Antonio, Texas, to California, and I heard the story of Harvey Milk. And it gave me hope. It gave me the hope to live my life. It gave me the hope to one day I could live my life openly as who I am, and that maybe even I could fall in love and one day get married. I want to thank my mom, who has always loved me for who I am, even when there was pressure not to. But most of all, if Harvey had not been taken from us 30 years ago, I think he'd want me to say to all of the gay and lesbian kids out there tonight who have been told that they are less than by their churches or by the government or by their families, that you are beautiful, wonderful creatures of value. And that no matter what anyone tells you, God does love you. And that very soon, I promise you, you will have equal rights federally across this great nation of ours. Thank you. Thank you. And thank you, God, for giving us Harvey Milk.
Sean Penn.
You commie, homo-loving sons of guns. I did not expect this, but I want it to be very clear that I do know how hard I make it to appreciate me often. But I am touched by the appreciation, and I hope for it enough that I did want to scribble down so I had the names in case you were commie, homo-loving sons of guns. And so I want to thank my best friend, Sato Matsuzawa, my circle of longtime support, Mara, Brian, Barry, and Bob, the great Cleve Jones, our wonderful writer, Lance Black, producers, Bruce Cohn and Dan Jenks, and particularly, as all us actors know, our director either has the patience, talent, and restraint to grant us a voice, or they don't, and it goes from the beginning of the meeting to through the cutting room, and there is no finer hands to be in than Gus Van Sant. Finally, for those who saw the signs of hatred as our cars drove in tonight, and I think that it is a good time for those who voted for the ban against gay marriage to sit and reflect and anticipate their great shame and the shame in their grandchildren's eyes if they continue that way of support. We've got to have equal rights for everyone.
Look at me. I'm standing right in front of you, still breathing. 'Cause there's a force inside of me, makes me strong. 'Cause the note God gave me.
Where did you go?
To London.
Yes.
handful of protesters outside the Kodak Theater in Hollywood, led by the infamous Fred Phelps and his mostly family Westboro Baptist Church, held signs such as Heath in Hell, referencing posthumous Dark Knight Best Supporting Actor Oscar winner Heath Ledger because of his work on Brokeback Mountain, along with their other usual hate-filled placards. And while LGBT viewers of the live Oscars telecast in the early morning hours in Asia enjoyed the show, they were angered when the Star Satellite Network, which claims to reach more than 300 million viewers in 53 countries, deleted all gay references from the evening rebroadcast of the ceremonies. Penn expanded on his comments about homophobia, again targeting the Kodak Theater protesters during his Q&A with the press backstage.
Congratulations. I asked you a couple questions at the SAG Awards. You were talking about that you actually remember Harvey Milk, being old enough to remember him. Can you talk about, now that you've won the highest honor in Hollywood, this award, what it means to you to be able to bring his story and how you feel important his story is that people understand what Harvey Milk was and what he represented?
Well, I that means a lot to myself and to everybody involved, not only in the movie, but to anybody who believes in equal rights for other human beings. It's pretty simple. And certainly, what I mentioned from the stage earlier tonight, to see this culture of ignorance and that breeds this kind of hateful expression that these people had the signs outside, essentially telling you that you're less than human. There's nothing more important than the themes that this movie, as well as addressing things that are simply, you know, entertaining, I think, but there's nothing more important than it. And so to be part of something like that's a privilege. And, you know, when you see something like what one saw outside today, it enhances that. Yeah.
In your acceptance speech, you mentioned President Barack Obama. I'm wondering, what would you like to see the president do in relation to gay rights?
Well, we know that his public position in terms of the specific issue of gay marriage has not been, let's say, officially supportive of that. I would like to believe that that's a political stand right now and not necessarily a future one or a felt one. I don't think that he or that any of us, and in particular our president, will long be able to take that position. It's inevitable that this is not, it's because it's not a human luxury. These are human needs, and they will be gotten. So he's going to have to, he'll adapt. Right now, I think I'm more focused on, I'm more interested in what we are going to do to tell him that we will support him in making those kinds of, taking those kinds of initiatives. He's got people dying right now, and in mass, and people desperately poor in mass and building. And I think those two emergencies need to be taken care of without me making too much comment about the details of how we approach human civil rights. But the day is going to come, and it's going to come quickly.
Best Original Screenplay Oscar winner Dustin Lance Black proved that the personal is indeed the political, as he addressed several lesbi-gay issues during his backstage comments.
Congratulations on your win. It was very touching, and I loved what you said. Do you think that President Obama should reverse his stand on gay marriage?
I think that there's a few things that I would love him to do immediately, which is to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell and DOMA, Defense of Marriage Act. But I do think that for inspiration for the gay community, we need to look not to the Proposition 8s, but dream bigger and look back to 1964 and the Civil Rights Act. Because no group has ever won full civil rights in this country, going state by state or county by county. I think it is time for the gay and lesbian community to have a federal Civil Rights Act for full civil rights.
Hey, Lance. Greg Hernandez, Daily News.
Hi!
Hey, how are you? Congrats.
Thank you.
Hey, you know, you were talking about how you were inspired by Harvey Milk when you were a kid.
Yeah.
I wonder, what would have happened if, say, you were 13 and you saw someone like you on the Oscars saying what you said? What do you think that would have done for you back then?
I don't know. I didn't hear that at the Oscars when I was a 13-year-old kid. I just hope it makes you feel a bit less alone. You know, it's easy in San Francisco and L.A. and New York, Chicago, because you can find support and you can find mentors and heroes. But where I'm from, and a lot of places, you know, in this country, the small town America, they just don't know that there are gay heroes, and they don't know that there's other gay people, and they don't know that there's a potential future. I mean, a beautiful future. Look at this. It's insane. So for out gay people. So I hope, you know, I hope it inspires some folks.
Have you ever had a dream of Oscar moment or any award moment? Did it fit to the expectation what you felt?
It's all sort of an out-of-body thing. I mean, definitely when we started this journey, I was, just charging hotel stays and gasoline on my credit card and driving out to meet with Cleve Jones or Ann Cronenberg in San Francisco. I mean, there was no studio. There's nothing like that. Your dream is don't screw it up, first of all. And your second is let's get it to a great director. And I was fortunate, and Gus got it to Sean. And it just kept being, you know, the very next thing in front of you. And then all of a sudden, 4 weeks ago, was a nomination. And it's just sort of unbelievable. I don't quite believe it yet. Maybe when I see my mom in a few minutes, I'll believe it.
Did you know what you were going to say if and when you got up there?
You know, I had an idea. I mean, for me, the whole thing was always to sort of, you know, pay it forward. You know, Harvey gave me his story. And Harvey gave me his story, and it saved my life. And I just thought, it's time to pass it on. So the only thing I really knew I wanted to say was to tell those kids out there that they're going to be all right.
Hi, congratulations. I'm Elena Scantlin from VCast.
Hi.
I wanted to know, at what point did you think that this film could grab the attention of the Academy?
I think that's an easy one. I think it was the moment that we first saw Sean with his hair cut, with the suit on, and he came in onto the set, and I was blown away at how much it reminded me of everything I'd heard and seen of Harvey. And I looked out to turn to Cleve, and I went, my God, that's him, isn't it? And Cleve was outside, like, smoking manically, going, oh, my God, I've seen a ghost. But that was the thing. I thought, you know, this film would only succeed if we could somehow get close to that charisma, because that charisma of Harvey Milk is what transcended his community. And I think it's what Sean has done that has transcended our community again and reached out to all these other people who I hope have embraced the film. I think they have.
That was Best Original Screenplay winner Dustin Lance Black during his Q&A with the press backstage at the 81st Annual Academy Awards.
Dust off that wine. Seems like you've been saving it since the start of time. All the papers haven't signed. Your wrongs become your rights that count. Tell all the fools to shove their boots of one out. Leave the union to your round and third base. Thanks to the ghost. Put that ring on your finger. Now there is no doubt. Don't ask, don't tell. Go to hell, cause love won't help. Don't ask, don't tell. Go to hell, cause love won't help. Cause love won't help.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Tanya Kane Perry, Lee Moore, Rex Walkner with Bill Kelly, and Sir Ian McKellen contributed program material. Scandell and Tokyo Rosenthal performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is made possible by donations from our listeners. Thank you. Log on to thiswayout.org to see how you can support our work, hear our podcasts, or subscribe to CDs of our programs. To receive our weekly program email alerts, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on 6RTR Perth, West Australia, WNJR Washington, Pennsylvania, KSKQ Ashland, Oregon, and more than 175 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
This Way Out is heard every week as part of Queer Voices. You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT.
Well, and if you haven't seen Milk yet, you really do need to go see it. Still playing at the River Oaks in the upstairs theater, which is nice and cozy.
I loved it. And, you know, if you watch the Academy Awards and the great speech, I mean, that should inspire you to go see it even more. And just to see the actors recreate the history is amazing.
I love the part that as soon as Harvey Milk became a supervisor in San Francisco, the first thing he wanted to do was pass a gay rights ordinance.
Yes. What a loss. I mean.
We want to thank our guests tonight, which includes David Elliott calling us in from Washington, Jennifer Renee, who came back from Austin for Lobby Day and talked about that.
We had Colleen Fisher talking about her concert coming up on the 17th for the Gay Men's Chorus of Houston. We had
Andy Northrup, who is from Canada, and J.D. interviewed him about his music.
And finally, we had the Houston Pride Band and Rudy talking about their upcoming concert this Saturday.
So join us next week, and we hope to be talking about the AIDS Walk. And we have BFLAG, which is the Blind
Friends of Lesbians and Gays.
And we'll see what else we're going to come up with. And I think we're going to do another wrap-up of Lobby Day with Paul Scott from Austin in Equality, Texas. And remember, you can get us on iTunes, and you can check us out on our website, queervoices.org.
Have been listening to Queer Voices, heard each Monday at 8 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Walensky. On-air voices are Glenn Holt, J.D. Doyle, Deborah Bell, Jennifer Renee, Greg Chapman, and Jack Walensky. Be sure to listen every Saturday night, Sunday morning at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. This is listener-sponsored and commercial-free Pacifica Radio, KPFT, at 90.1 FM, 89.5 FM Galveston, and worldwide via streaming audio from kpft.org. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
KPFT is now accepting nominations for listener members to its program council. The KPFT Program Council is an advisory body founded to give broader community input in programming. The PC works with KPFT's management around a myriad of programming matters. KPFT is seeking 6 listener members to participate in the program council. Visit kpft.org to apply now and make plans to attend the Wednesday, March 18th local station board meeting to be held at the Haven Center, 1827 West Alabama, between Woodhead and South Shepherd in Houston. At kpft.org. www.ACB.org, you can find full information about the Program Council, what it does, and how it works. You can also submit your own nomination to the Program Council. And don't forget to attend the March 18th local station board meeting to be held at the Haven Center, 1827 West Alabama, and speak to the board, which votes on your nomination. KPFT encourages members of our diverse listening audience to get involved in this radio station. Visit KPFT.org for information about the Program Council. This is KPFT Houston.
Hunger is a reality for as many as 35,000 Houstonians every day. Help these hungry Houstonians by making a purchase at the 5th Annual Empty Bowls Houston, Saturday, March 21st in the Museum District. This unique lunch event is a grassroots effort to fight hunger, held locally to benefit the Houston Food Bank. Handcrafted bowls made and donated by local artists are the centerpiece of the event. For a minimum donation of $25, enjoy a simple lunch and select from hundreds of one-of-a-kind handcrafted bowls to keep as a reminder of those who experience hunger daily. The event will be held 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. at two neighboring locations in the Museum District on Main Street, Lawndale Arts Center and Houston Center for Contemporary Craft. Enjoy live art demonstrations throughout the day and live music by Runaway Sun. A limited selection of celebrity bowls is also available. Help the Houston Food Bank.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.